Thank you so much for that, Dr. Ahmed. I'm sure you're all touched by that final few words as well. Sorry. I keep on telling myself, but hopefully to be, definitely. I think, well, for me personally, a lot of the things that were mentioned right at the end, the call for dialogue and the idea of thinking about good and how we define good things, that's really what touched me. And I'm sure you were touched by several other things, and thus you've got so many questions going through your head. And also particularly the fact that the food crisis that we're mentioning at the start and the images that we were showing at the start is actually related to economics and ethics and so many other things, those 5 points that you mentioned as well. So really it just shows how it links back to our previous campaign about the economy and about so many other things that can go on in our lives as well. But I think obviously there's not much for me to say. The talk have really covered so many things that I'm sure have stimulated so many questions in your mind, which obviously brings us now to the questions and answer session. I'll leave for about 20 minutes for this, 20 minutes to half an hour, seeing if everyone is prepared to stay on for as long as possible. But please, from where you are, just raise your hand and try to keep the questions nice and short, and we'll try to keep as many questions as possible. So please, any questions from the floor, just raise your hand and we'll try to answer them. Okay, as in me personally, I've got a few questions regarding, you mentioned a bit about the population growth, and how much is the food crisis attributed to the agribusiness compared to the growth of population? Because we know over the past century, population growth has risen exponentially. So how can it be that that is not causing a shortage in food, for example?
Yeah, I tried to address that issue in the talk, and I think it's pretty simple. When you take the amount of food that is being produced and ask the question of, is production actually able to meet the needs of the entire population? And mathematically it is. There is more than enough being produced to actually feed the entire world's population. The question is, where is it going? And what you find is that there is huge waste. I mean, some of it is going, most of it is obviously going to the west and north. But you have practices like food dumping. You have, to keep prices high in the west, companies obviously dump food, millions of tons of food, just to keep prices high. So there's a lot of other issues as well that I didn't mention, but the key evidence is that issue, that you have, there is ample food available, this whatever the growth of the population. And even with further growth of the population, there's still ample food, even within the current structure of the food industry. So it's the question, the issue is distribution and ownership, really, and the inequalities there.
Right, okay. So you raise your hand first.
Yeah.
A bit on the grey top.
Me.
Yes.
Yeah, talk about being in a Soviet style, assuming that we're already in one right now, food being used as a weapon, maybe eugenics, coming into this. I mean, how does that play into, you talk a lot about from facts coming from the UN.
Could you repeat your question?
Yeah, sorry, as in I couldn't quite understand. It was a bit.
Well, given that you were talking about where you could end up in a Soviet style, where it's kind of we're all getting equal quotas, and as you say, the stuff belongs to everybody on the planet. Given that the world bankers around the world are kind of controlling both food and everything, so we could actually be in that system already. I mean, how do you feel about food being used as a weapon by stealth and eugenics?
Yeah, and I think it's more to do with the fact that I think it's relating back to the agribusiness, am I right? The fact that food is being used as a source of power. Okay. What, do you want to give the whole talk again then?
No, it's fine.
Yeah?
It's fine, yeah. I'm not sure if I grasp what you're suggesting. You seem to be saying that, because I'm not sure I actually got the question. You said that you mentioned the issue of food being used as a weapon.
Yeah, because it's been, you know, it's been talked about that food shortages in Africa are merely to kill people off, and the whole supply and demand is being regulated by huge bankers who have vested interests in population control. But the UN, they have a population control department. Now you're using a lot of UN facts, and I just wonder how you, what you have you added eugenics into your equation of your lecture?
No, obviously I haven't added it in. The issue of there's a number of issues you've brought in. You've brought in the I think you're talking about the Kissinger plan in the 1970s,
well, which took. Okay.
Okay. It's not helpful to speak generically of, you know, wars and population control. It doesn't communicate anything to me. I can understand specifically when you're talking about eugenics and a specific plan for population reduction, for example, in the South. I get that. What are you asking? Are you asking me if this is a part of that plan?
Yeah, I'm wondering how you put that into account when you were thinking of this lecture.
Okay. First of all, in terms of the use of statistics, I'm not sure if you're, because you haven't actually said anything specific and you've not asked a specific question. I'm trying to guess what you're trying to say.
But you kind of asked us the question when you were saying, you know, about should we be heading towards this kind of socialist system? What I'm saying is, do you think we're actually in there?
We're not in a socialist system. Okay. Not at all. There is a very specific distinction between Soviet-style socialist economics and neoliberal capitalist economics. It's different. Sometimes the result can be the same. I mean, under the Soviet Union, Stalin ended up killing like 30, 40 million people because of his collectivization plans. Whereas under neoliberal capitalism, you've got, you know, at this state, we can say we're talking about, you know, hundreds, almost a billion people at risk of death and starvation as a result. So the effect could be the same. It's the mechanism which differs slightly, but very significantly. And it's important to understand that distinction. So with the Soviet-style thing, you see, a lot of people talk about New World. When they talk about New World Order, they get very confused, and they say that the UN wants to bring in a socialist one-world government. They're not getting the picture. This is not. Yes, you know, they're trying to centralize and increase control of the global political economy. Calling it a socialist one world government doesn't communicate anything about the nature of this system. It just says, oh, it's communist. Ooh, we Americans who hate the bloody Russians and communists, we're going to reject that. And like people like Alex Jones, unfortunately, oversimplifies things in that respect. He gets a lot of other things very right. That's one of the things he gets very wrong. What's happening?
Can I just interrupt you? I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
You said earlier on you were talking about South American countries and saying that basically they gave up their resources to it. You know, but you didn't explain that the World Bank actually went in and gave them huge loans, okay, which they couldn't pay back, and then they took their resources. You know?
Yeah.
They didn't give them by choice. They didn't just say, come and take the oil and water and gas. They gave them money to make them bankrupt.
Yeah, well, I wasn't trying to suggest. I mean, come on, look, give me a chance. I said, I mentioned the World Bank, and I said that the World Bank forced governments to give up their resources. I mean, come on. I mean, okay, I would expect you to ask me the question, what did you mean by that? Rather than, you said that they gave it up willingly. I don't think anyone in their right mind.
Okay. I think it really does relate to, because we talked a lot about this actually in our previous campaign about the role of the World Bank and how it contributes to the economic crisis. But just to really quick summarise, so I can get questions from other people, I think it's just about the misconception that of this socialist idea in the world that doesn't actually exist, I think, which is the main thing that you're trying to...
I'm not sure.
Well, I'm sure that there'll be a lot of opportunity, but I just like to give opportunity for other people to ask questions as well. Thank you so much, though. Yeah.
Yeah, I can hear you.
I will repeat the question as well, just for the people as well.
Yeah, you talk, like, I'm trying to make the links between food production and power and distribution and ownership, with also companies and corporations that have a lot of money. Mika made me aware that that companies like, for example, I mean, you touched on a few, agricultural companies. I don't know if you know very much about Walmart, that if I say, okay, Walmart has more power, sort of maybe economic power, than a whole country like Finland. And I think that may be factual. But if you take that into consideration, then where does that, in terms of them having all of that power, relate to this complete crash that's going to occur in oil and everything? If they're going to have all of that power, then we're trying to suss out a new way of functioning, right? A new way of distributing food, a new way, and like you said, there's enough food for everyone. But in terms of money, is it going to be a case of these people having all of this economic power and therefore being able to dictate what goes on, as opposed to, do you understand what I'm trying to say?
I think, are you trying to say, is it going towards them getting more and more power, or is it going towards everything collapsing?
What I mean is when it comes to a crash,
okay.
Are they going to have the power to dictate what happens?
Okay.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, so basically, is the crash going to cause a catastrophe, or is it going to cause these big corporations to gain more and more?
Yeah.
I think that's the main question.
What's happened is that, I mean, this is obviously an issue that, I know, I can't pretend to have decisive answers. I can only give you my opinion and hope that it's based on something substantial. But my perspective is that it's a bit of both. But the outcome is ultimately, it's going to be devastating for the majority of the world's people. A lot of people there's a few people who are kind of thinking that, oh, you know, it's a crisis, it's going to be the end of capitalism, you know, world order is going to, you know, there's going to be new hope, blah, blah, blah. It's not happening like that, not by any standard at all. What's happened is that I would say a number of the most powerful elite institutions, for example, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, some of the big banks in the Federal Reserve, not even all of them necessarily, but certainly certain cliques who are very powerful, as well as very big financiers, a few very big financial groups, so maybe the Rothschilds, maybe a couple of other groups, pretty much anticipated that there was going to be a major crisis. But from what I've spoken to a number of people who have worked in financial institutions at senior levels, and they've said to me that they think that even though they anticipated what was going to happen, they didn't realise how bad it was going to hit them. And elements of the crisis have taken them by surprise. They didn't expect that the financial system would just come crashing down the way it has, because, you know, millions and billions and billions of profits have been lost. But having said that, they've reacted very, very fast to restructure and reorganise control of the system. And I'm going to give a very concrete example of how that worked. General Motors, for example, is a giant, you know, American company. Automobile, produces automobiles. It's got investments in defense. You know, it's very influential. It's a big player. The extent to which they were affected by the crash was unexpected. Their share prices plummeted. They ended up having to sack loads of workers. People have been saying that the American automobile industry is just, you know, it's completely dead. No one wants to buy any cars at the moment. It's just gone down rock bottom. Now, what's happened is that at the same time, the financiers who've been pressuring for the bailouts have been taking taxpayers' money, and those bailouts have not gone into, in any, they're not about, it's not about, they talk about liquidity, and they talk about, we need to get more money to basically allow us to lend more, to allow, you know, more spending to take place and get the real economy going and blah, blah, blah. All they've done is taken huge amounts of billions of dollars and pounds of taxpayers' money, and literally it's gone to corporate bonuses. It's gone into the pockets of the very, very rich. And what they've done with their profits is they're now buying up some of the shares in these real economy companies like General Motors, And there's this process of restructuring consolidation where the big financiers, who normally, traditionally, they don't necessarily own productive resources, they have another kind of element of control, they're consolidating control of the real economy. And by that I mean they're controlling giant companies that actually produce things. They're not just making money out of finance and financial products and all that. They're doing more. So there is this restructuring going on, and it's more and more centralized. And what they're doing is they're allowing smaller banks to first, they're saying, okay, you know, whatever, let the smaller banks fall. And the biggest banks will merge and will get more centralized. So it is basically they're exploiting the situation to basically create a very, very devastating environment. I mean, this is a killer capitalism. This is worse than anything we've seen over the last few decades. So I don't want to say that. I don't want us to underestimate how much they're kind of making the situation worse. And so as things are tightening, the bad effects of this are basically being distributed onto the poorer and more vulnerable sectors of the world population, both, you know, in the south as well as here in the west and the north. So yeah, it doesn't bode very well in that respect. But I guess from our perspective as activists, our perspective is I guess what the crisis has done is open up recognition that the system is wrong and that the system has failed on some level, and that can be used to raise wider awareness that, you know, you actually have to transform and understand and transform the system completely and look for something new.
So I think it's more like things are going towards change.
Things are getting worse.
But you're hoping for
things are not going to change unless people stand up and do something.
I think
the thing. I mean, that's what this is about. It's about making people aware that these things, something needs to give. Basically,
sure.
It's going to get a lot worse.
Okay,
but, you know, over the next few decades, it's going to get a lot worse.
Things need to. Does that answer your question then?
Yeah, it does. I think I'm just really, my concern is because I know that there have been alternatives to our current, let's say, electrical systems, our current ecological systems, and there have been alternatives for a number of years. And like you said, this whole biofuel or something. You're
so alternatives,
biodiesel is different, just different from biofuels.
Biodiesel, right. All of these different alternatives, okay? But a lot of these alternatives have been in place for quite some time. It just bothers me the fact that the power, as in who's going to get listened to, as we can see, these alternatives are in place in order that, you know, the oil crisis or whatever doesn't affect us so much or whatever, that we do have a way out, and yet people aren't being listened to, and those things, in order to have them in place, you have to spend so much money to actually have them put in your car or...
You see, what they realise is that, because the current system is based on control of certain regions, control of certain resources, control of certain states, blah blah blah. Now, if they go for a completely different system, which is based on distributed ownership, for example, and, you know, alternative renewable energies, which are not based on controlling a central, we've got control of Saudi Arabia and we've got control of Iraq and now we control everything, which is how the economy functions now, literally, because the United States and Britain and Western Europe have dominance over control of oil and gas regions, they control the world economy to some extent. Now, if they allow other alternative energies to become prominent and to become more cost effective, then it won't matter if you've gone to Iraq. It won't matter if you control Saudi Arabia. In fact, it's a waste of bloody time, because we can live happily on the basis of renewable resources which are there in the earth. And we can grow sustainable food without having to rely on Asda, Walmart and all the rest of it. That's what they're worried about. That it will completely devastate the profit system. And that's why they would much rather, and I guess this gets back to what the gentleman was saying about eugenics, that you have to ask the question that have not calculated decisions at some level been made? Are elites completely oblivious to what is going on? No, it is their job to plan. It is their job to make contingencies. They've made contingencies for climate change. They've thought about what will happen with peak oil, even though they publicly officially deny it. They've thought about all of these crises, and they're thinking, well, if we actually change, then we won't be here in the next 10, 20 years. We'll just be like anyone else, and we won't have extensive control. No. It's much better to continue centralization, divert attention by making people become increasingly fascistic, thinking about Muslims and asylum seekers and whatever country is out there that supposedly wants to invade us and kill us. Let's think about lots of other things and become crazy fascists. And then meanwhile, we can keep centralizing. And then let's mind my friends, but when the shit really hits the fan and people can't eat, they don't have access, they're too busy thinking about the guy who's going to invade us, then thinking about, well, these guys, these banking systems and these elites have created a system that has raped my family, that has created injustice, and that has made me lose my job. I'm going to revolt against them, and I'm going to create a new system. No, they're going to think about, I want to go and kill my brown black neighbour because he's taken my jobs. That's what it's become. We're seeing this polarisation now. And you have to ask the question. I mean, this has been going on now. We've seen this before 9/11. We've seen it accelerated after 9/11. We're seeing it in the UK accelerated after 7/7. Can you really honestly tell me this is not deliberate, you know, on some level? There are people in these institutions who know what's going on, and they're deliberately allowing it. And they'd much rather have millions of people die than have change and control what they can. And I think that's the harsh reality of what we're looking at. But where the optimism comes in, from my perspective, is that they can do what they like, but at the end of the day, there's more of us than there is of them. We are the majority. There's only so much we can take. You know, and I look forward to that time, and my idea is that if we build understanding and knowledge of all of these issues, not just one issue, but of all the things that are going on now, from terrorism, you know, what happened on 9/11, what's going on with the economy, food, if we build understanding in a holistic way, then people will develop a more holistic understanding and be able to arm themselves with ideas.
I think it's lectures like this that obviously, you know, set the ball rolling, hopefully. Thank you. Okay, so hopefully that answers your question, please. Any more questions? Just, yeah, you at the back.
I was just wondering if I can get your view on the opinion that...
it was actually the lady behind you. I'm sorry, you've already asked a question. Sorry, sir.
I commented on someone else's question.
Okay, go on, but then you're after. Okay, yeah.
It's just about peak oil. Some skeptics will point to the fact that the Republic worked with Shell.
Yeah. I don't basically disagree with the idea of engineering and manipulation of crises. Where I disagree with those people who start saying, oh, it's just all, you know, he worked for Shell. I mean, if that's the case, then we can't basically believe anything because they worked for someone who had some relation to the mainstream. That is not, you can't just say someone worked for Shell, I don't want to listen to him. There are other people who've worked for oil industry companies who are, for example, who reject the 9/11 official narrative and also reject peak oil. Actually, Ian Crane is one of them. And I disagree with him on his view of the oil crisis. But I could say that, oh, because he used to work for an oil company for 30-odd years, anything he says about oil is a lie. That's just silly. What we have to do is look at the argument. Now, this is where, again, it's a case of you have to do your own research. I can't tell you this is the answer, and I don't want to say this is the answer, and that you should accept it. But my view is that peak oil is very, very clearly established scientifically. I can tell you the arguments against it. The main argument is abiotic theory, which says that it's a completely alternative geological theory, which was kind of used by the Russians by the 70s, and they actually did publish papers on it. And the idea is that basically oil, I can't remember the exact dynamics, but they basically say the oil is basically replenishable from the ground. It's not basically formed through hundreds and thousands of years, millennia of geological formation. It can be replenished from the mantle. Now, the problem with this theory is there's a weak version and a strong version. And actually, there was a very interesting critique by a guy called Hugo Bardi, who's a professor of chemistry. He wrote a very short piece on Michael Rupert's website, From the Wilderness. And if you Google it, you'd probably be able to find it. And he basically just gave two... If it's the weak theory, and the majority of abiotic theorists, who, by the way, are in a minority and don't publish in peer-reviewed journals here in the West, they just don't get published, they basically argue that... abiotic theory, they argue for a weak version of the theory, that the process is different, but it's not faster than normal petroleum production. It still takes millennia. So that's kind of irrelevant, basically, for peak oil. It's just, it doesn't matter how it's formed. In the day, it's a time scale, the issue. But if you take the strong theory that it replenishes, the problem is that its predictive value is nil, because if it was true, we would literally be drowning in oil. The amount of oil that would be coming out of everywhere, it would create so much carbon that it would offset the whole CO2 feedback mechanism, positive feedback mechanism in the atmosphere. It would be really clear what was going on. The whole atmosphere would be totally messed up. So, I mean, Hugo Bardi's argument is that the strong theory just isn't there. Basically, it just can't be proven. So, and the weak theory is irrelevant. So this is basically not a very strong argument. The other theories are that, well, not so much theories, they're just basically ideas about, I mentioned before, unconventional oil, tar sands and oil shale. And the argument is that, yeah, you know, we've got abundant oil reserves in the form of these unconventional oil deposits, which are basically, it's not conventional oil. It's it's very difficult to get out of the ground. And the problem is, we just don't have the technology to get it out. Now, maybe by some miracle, we might develop this technology in 10, 20 years. But at the moment, the way we're doing it, as I said, is completely inefficient. We're using more energy to get out the product so it's just not worth it. Mm. So that's really the sum of it in terms of where I stand on peak oil.
Yeah, yeah. I think touching a lot, reiterating a lot of the points that were in the lecture as well. Absolutely. Okay, yeah, lady at the back. I'm afraid this is going to have to be the last question, but there will be opportunity. We will hang around for a bit after for more questions as well. Okay, yeah. So, okay. Differences between Islamic economics and socialism. You want to tackle that?
It's a huge question, which I don't actually have the answers to. There's no such thing as an ignorant question. I can give you a very basic thing. Basically, in terms of their ideology, their outlook, and focusing purely on the economic issues, let's look at the production issues. Capitalism says you should basically have private ownership of production, and it's completely free, open to all. You know, and specifically, it's not just private ownership. What they're saying is that workers should be dispossessed from the means of production. So what I mean is, we don't own a farm. You and me, if we want to live and eat, we have to go and get a job. We have to have some skills and sell them to some bastard capitalist. Sorry, just mind my French again.
Second time.
And that's basically how we do things. Now, that condition, again, it's kind of an artificial condition in the sense that what's happened really is that capitalists, if you want to put it like that, have basically taken over the whole world, dispossessed everybody and said, actually, you know what, this is ours, yeah? This oil is ours, this water is ours, these minerals are ours, and you're going to work for us at this cost, and that's how it's going to be. And we're kind of like, okay, we don't have a choice. We have to go and get ourselves in the job market. Now, socialism, where it's different from that is in the idea of ownership. What they say is that, oh, look, we're going to emancipate the workers, and we're going to say that the workers should have access to their means of production. And this is where we get into the difficulties, because Marxists have huge disagreements about what Marx meant. And probably Marx would also have disagreements about what he meant. And if you read Das Kapital, I mean, it's a huge book, it's difficult, it's very interesting, and it has a lot of brilliant insights into capitalism, and it's also extremely confusing. And it's not always clear, and there are contradictions as well in what he argues. And then there's what people argued after him, like people like Lenin, obviously Stalin himself, and other Marxist theorists. But to put it very simply, I would say that Marx was basically, he kind of looked at capitalism and he said, there's private ownership, that's bad, let's have public ownership. And he didn't really think about how it would work, but he said, workers have to have ownership of the means of production. And he didn't really know how it would get there. So when it came to working it out with Engels, it was kind of like, well, you know, if you're going to get to this point, how are we going to get to this point? Well, we have to have a workers' revolution, and then obviously you have to have a group of workers who are going to basically represent the workers and kind of control things for them and allocate resources. It was going to be very nice. And in practice, when that happened, you got Stalin, who basically said, yes, I represent the workers. And in effect, what he did was wasn't very different to capitalism in some respects, because it was still centralized control of resources. Mm-hmm. But where it was different was in, it was so centralized that it was controlled by the state only, whereas in capitalism, you've got a multiplicity of different actors who have various relationships with the state. So it's all very multi-layered.
Private companies.
And there are certain, that difference also creates different dynamic. Capitalism has certain tendencies and socialism has other tendencies. And where I think Islamic economics, which is also, there's some similarities with binary economics, where the difference is, the argument is that your ownership of production should be, no one should, there's certain resources that no one should be allowed to monopolize in Islamic economics. Mm. Things like oil and natural gas, water, are considered to be owned by the public. Mm. And you cannot allow any private monopoly. Now, I don't know how the mechanism is supposed to work for that. What the general argument then is that private ownership of production is permitted as long as it's premised on work, on labour. You can't have someone who doesn't work, who hasn't actually involved in labour, saying that I own this and this is mine and you guys work under me. It's not going to work like that. There has to be some kind of joint ownership. I don't know how, there's a lot of different theorists you can look at. There's Ayatollah Barker al-Sadr, who wrote one of the seminal books on Islamic economics. There's also another guy, Muhammad Umar Chapra, who's also written on Islamic economics. And he's a contemporary economist. And so if you want to read more about it, you can get some from there. Mm. And that's...
No, that's a great suggestion. I mean, it's a very, very good question, very big as well. And I think you did it very much justice in just the few moments that we have.
Are you referring to cooperativism?
I beg your pardon?
Cooperativism.
Sorry, I didn't quite get it.
When a group of workers own the factory, for example, that's cooperativism. That's what
cooperativism, you mean?
Yeah, that's what you're referring
okay,
to.
Right. No, it's not. I mean, I don't know how Islamic economics would actually work in practice. I mean, there are books and studies written about it. Binary economics, as I mentioned before, they have theories of cooperative ownership more specifically worked out. I'd have no idea what Islamic economists have worked out. Mm. But certainly binary economics, where there are some parallels with Islamic economics, have specifically said that cooperative ownership of factories or whatever is a necessity. Mm. You know, and they've referred to some mechanisms which are actually already in practice in the United States, for example, where they actually do have some companies operating joint ownership of shares and things like that.
Definitely, yeah. If there's any more like comments or suggestions, please come down. We're hanging around for a little bit after, but I'm afraid we're gonna have to round off the questions and answers. Please, if you can join me just to thank and give another round of applause for Mr. Nafisa. Thank you so much. Thank you. And again, just to sort of like round off a few, the main thing that was mentioned right at the end of the talk was the idea of trying to strive for dialogue and strive for a discussion and bringing so many different groups and different faith groups together. And that's really a lot of what our society, Ahlul Bayt Society, has been trying to do this year, this term. And there's a few people, again, in the audience that attend also. There's on Wednesdays, there's an interfaith dialogue session, and which really tries to bring a lot of people together. It's held by the chaplaincy at Imperial College for people to come and discuss, and you can always discuss issues like this about social justice and about a lot of the issues that were covered today, for example. So just to mention that. And also do you want to
yeah, we can see the website up there if you yeah. want to. You can also get my email from the website if you want to contact me.
Yeah, so that's International for Policy Research and Development, of which Nafees is the executive director for, situated in London, which is doing a lot of tackling a lot of issues like what we discussed today as well. Apart from that, I'd like to thank you all for attending, and please don't forget to hand in your feedback forms outside when you collect your refreshments. This will help us to improve in our events. And yes, there are refreshments outside, so please make yourselves welcome. And we'll be hanging around, like I said, for any other further discussion. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Sorry, but I think one of the questions and answers.
Yeah. How do I just do? Just close it.
Thanks so much.
No worries, man.